So last week in this series we're looking at the tree of refuge and respect from the Tree Ratna movement, which has loads and loads of different figures on it. And we're looking at some of the figures on the tree in different themes. So the theme we're going on at the moment is the three protectors, the three families of protectors, which are the protectors are aspects of the enlightened mind, and their wisdom, compassion, and energy. And Vidanya talked last week about Manjushri, who is an embodiment of the wisdom aspect of enlightenment, and he's an archetypal figure. And this week I'm going to talk about a man called Milarepa, who is a historical aspect of the enlightened mind. So he's someone who actually lived. I first came across Milarepa about 15 or 16 years ago, and I was shown this little book, and somebody said to me, "It's a very good read. I suggest you read it." And they had a little bit of an idea that it might be useful to me, because I was trying to decide whether I could actually become a Buddhist, whether I could practice within a Buddhist context. I'd been a meditator for quite a long time, about 10 years or so, and I could see that the Dharma was very rational, and it was very logical, and it seemed to make a lot of sense to me. But I knew that putting it into practice was going to be hard work, and it was going to be quite another thing to move it from it being a good idea to being a way of life. And so it was going to be a big step, and I was not sure I could do it. I could see that I'd got a lot of bad habits, and I knew that I would have to kind of change quite radically to be able to commit myself to Buddhism, to a Buddhist life, to a Dharmic life. And I could see that that was going to be hard work, and I didn't know if I was up to it. So I got lent this little book, and this little book is called The Life of Milarepa. And it just really helped me think again. It helped me put the sort of questions I was having into a different kind of perspective. It's a very inspirational book. It's a cracking good story. And it's not that hard to read. It reads more like a novel. So if you feel like that bit of bedtime reading that's quite exciting and dharmic at the same time, that little book is very good. And the Milarepa was actually a very bad boy. And I thought, well, you know, if he could do it, then maybe there was a chance I could too. But I also knew through reading this book that I would have to be very committed, I would have to be dedicated, and I would also have to work hard. My suspicions were correct. It would be hard work. But importantly for me, through my meditation, I knew that my meditation would lead to a kind of relaxation and a kind of happiness which stood outside what was going on in my life. And this little book and Milarepa's story confirmed that to me, that walking the path of the Dharma could also be a joyful pursuit. It would be hard work, but it could be fun too. Okay, it could be very uplifting. So, who was Milarepa? Well, historically, he's an 11th century Tibetan Buddhist enlightened master. He's depicted in Tibetan art as being nearly naked. He just wears a little white cloth. And he's sitting cross-legged in a cave in snowy mountains, in the snowy mountains of Tibet. And he's pale green in colour. And that's because for many years he's just been eating nettles. And his hand is cupped to his ear like this. And that's a kind of indication, a pictorial indication, to show that he's singing. And one of the things that he's very famous for are his songs. And there are 100,000 songs of Milarepa, but I don't think they're quite that many, but they're a real lot. And his stories and his songs are deeply woven into Tibetan spiritual life, into Tibetan Buddhism. They're the sort of thing that children will learn at school, stories about him and his songs. So they're a huge part of Tibetan culture. His biography was written in the 12th century by one of his disciples and was translated into English in 1928. So it actually was a very, for us in the West, an early Dharma book, and very important because of that. His songs weren't translated until 1962. I think it's very difficult sometimes to realise how much wealth of Dharma we have available to us, which just has not been available until the relatively recent past. I think we're very fortunate in that way. So Milarepa's story is the story of a bad boy turned enlightened master. And it's a really good read, and it's a good teaching. In the book, it's a story, and it's a real biography. It's a drama of significant events in Milarepa's life. It doesn't have any commentary to it. The book allows the events to speak for themselves. So in the opening chapters, we meet Milarepa, and we have a bit of information about his family circumstances. So he was born into a village in western Tibet. His father was a woolen trader, and by local standards, a wealthy man. At the age of 7, his father dies, and on his father's deathbed, his uncle and aunt promise to look after Milarepa, his mother and his sister. Unfortunately, they don't do that. They succumb to the mental poisons of greed, hatred and delusion, and they deprive Milarepa, his sister, of their mother, of all the land and property, and treat them like slaves. So they're treated very badly and kept in poverty. And Milarepa really begins to understand what suffering is about. When Milarepa is 14-ish, his mother masterminds revenge on the family, and she just wants the aunt and the uncle to be destroyed. She just wants them out of their life. Well, you could understand that, couldn't you? If you'd been treated that badly. And Milarepa is a very devoted son, and he loves his mum, and he wants to please her. You know, he just wants to be able to please his mother. And he also has a lot of personal resentment against his aunt and his uncle. And he goes to train with a lama who is a master of sorcery. So he goes to train with a magician. And the lama teaches him the dark arts, the secret magic of destruction. And at a wedding feast, Milarepa brings down the house on top of his relatives. The home of his aunt and uncle collapse, and 36 of his family are killed. So that's pretty dramatic, isn't it? And not only that happens, but his mum sends word to him to say that the village people are understandably a bit annoyed and threaten to seek revenge. And once more, Milarepa just swings into action, and he destroys the crops of the village with hailstones. And then things get worse, so the villagers threaten to kill him, and Milarepa flees. He flees into the mountains. And that's just the beginning of the story. You know, that's like the first few pages. You know, we have this wild life going on. And in the consequences of his crimes dawn on Milarepa once he's fled from his village on his own, and they dawn on him with a terrible mental anguish and all-consuming fear. He is very, very aware and awakened to a sense of a deeper order which exists in life, and with that comes a tremendous shock of recognition. And Milarepa sees that he's been in the grip of hatred and delusion himself, and obeying the evil forces of mind, and has done not only huge damage to others, but also has hugely damaged himself. And with the same determination he brought to his desire for the black arts, he begins his search for truth and enlightenment, and he sets out on a quest. He sets out on a noble quest, the search for truth and liberation. Milarepa, like all of us, cannot escape the consequences of his actions. And this is the major theme of the story of his life. His story, his history, is the working out of this karma. So, because this is like the main theme of the story, I just want to break off from Milarepa at the moment, and I want to talk about karma for a bit. We will all have come across it, and perhaps we use the word, but it's not always easy to be clear about what karma is, because it has a very sort of populist view, which sometimes is a bit off message. So before I go into the next thrilling stage of Milarepa's story, I just want to be clear about what karma is. And to do this, we need to go back to what the Buddha taught. So the fundamental experience of the Buddha when he became enlightened was what was later referred to as pratita samuppada. We've got the word there. And it's difficult to translate, but it's often translated into English as something like conditioned co-production, conditioned arising, or dependent arising. And we have the most famous way of it being expressed on that piece of wood over there, which I'm delighted to see in this shrine room, because it's the crux of the Buddha's teaching and understanding. And it just says, this being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. Doesn't sound very exciting, does it? But it basically means we never act in isolation. Everything that we do creates the world around us, creates ourselves and creates the world around us. And everything is dependent on conditions. Nothing is random. So it has actually huge implications for the way we live. So this was a spiritual insight that the Buddha had. This is a kind of a deep understanding of the world and a way of experiencing the world. And for the rest of his life, the Buddha taught nothing but pratita samuppada, the understanding of conditions within our lives, taught this truth in different ways. Different ways. He taught it through practices so that we can understand it. He taught it through ethics. The Eightfold Path, which you do on the newcomer's course, that is pratita samuppada, that's an understanding of conditionality. The Four Noble Truths, understanding of conditionality. He just taught it in different ways over and over again in the hope that we might be able to grasp where we were going and why we were going there. So the Wheel of Life is a picture of conditioned co-production, pratita samuppada. Meditation and ethical practices are essential for the realisation of this truth. They give us the tools so that we can understand it. Pratita samuppada is like a natural law. It's like gravity. And in Buddhist time, people just used to say, oh, it's just the way things are. Pratita samuppada is the way things are. So karma, karma in a Buddhist sense, is the workings of conditionality in the realm of human action. simply put, this law is about the real consequences of our actions. And action here is not only about our physical actions, but also our actions of speech and actions of thought. I was on a retreat many years ago and somebody was talking about this, and I remember having a little discussion group and going, well, I can understand how my actions have consequences, and I can understand how what I say would make a difference. But thoughts, let's get real. You know, I just don't understand how that can happen. You know, my thoughts are private, Nobody knows what I think. Oh, I don't know, didn't know myself. In fact, I still don't know every time I think something, what my thoughts are. But I just really couldn't understand how thoughts could be actions. And in fact, Sangharakshita, who's the founder of Triratna, says this. This is the reason why thoughts are actions. The thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit. The habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring with love, born out of concern for all beings. Because without that initial thought, we wouldn't do anything. So our actions derive from our patterns of thinking. And that's a really important thing to understand. And that's one of the reasons why we meditate, so we know what our patterns of thinking are and we can start to change them. So there are several important things we need to know about karma. It's a natural law. There is no cosmic policeman. So when something happens, you know, it's not somebody condemned us or a being's out there making a decision that we're going to suffer or anything like that. It is just a natural process. It's in line with the way things are. It's in line with Pratita Samuppada. And to understand karma, it's necessary to understand that the outcome of our actions depend on the intention which is behind them. So an action might look like one thing, but it might actually be another, which is why it's very difficult to judge other people on what you see them do, because you don't know what the intention behind an action is. Unskillful. So we have skillful and unskillful actions, and you've all done this as newcomers, but I'm just going to remind you that unskillful actions have what's known as the three mental poisons behind them, and their close friends. They have a lot of close friends. And the three mental poisons are greed, hatred, and delusion. Skillful and positive actions have the intention of promoting kindness, generosity, and come from a spiritual clarity. The outcome of our actions affect others and the world around us. So that's quite obvious, that's quite easy to see sometimes. Through our actions of today, we build our world of tomorrow. The choices we make all the time create the world in a very real way. And in some ways, we could say that we deserve the world that we get. So I can listen to the news or read a newspaper, and I can get very distressed, because we do live in a world where some pretty terrible things happen. But then I look at why people might be acting like that, and lo and behold, we have greed, hatred, and delusion. We get the world which are created by the mental states that create it. And not only does our actions affect the world, other people, and our world around us, but in a very Buddhist understanding, it affects us directly too. It has feedback onto us. And our actions also have internal consequences. It may not be obvious. Sometimes it's very obvious. When I was at university, I hated my law lectures, and I really didn't want to go. And I persuaded a woman on my course to let me have her notes, so that I can be quite persuasive. And I knew she was a bit of a soft touch as well, which was useful at the time, but possibly not very skillful. And so she lent me her law notes, and I photocopied them, and I kept them safe. And then when I was doing my revision for my finals, I discovered that the photocopier hadn't been working very well, and the powder was not fixed onto the paper. And every time I moved the paper, a bit of the words came out. And I thought, maybe I should have gone to these lectures. It would have been better. And I was relating this to a friend of mine, and she just went, it's the wheel of the Dharma and its sharp knives. And I thought, yes, it probably was. So sometimes, you know, we can have something very direct like that happens, and we just think, yes, well, what am I to expect? So sometimes it's a bit obvious like that because it can externally manifest, but sometimes it's just manifest through our mental states. So if we've done something we would rather we had not, we would experience remorse, we'd be ashamed of our actions, we might feel guilty. We might want to avoid the person that we've acted badly against, that is not unknown. And all of this is quite unpleasant. And it may even curtail the way that we live. So by acting unskillfully towards other people, we actually curtail our own well-being. So through karma, our actions will also create our character. All human beings do have free choice, and by making choices, we create our habits, our character, and our future. Many of things that happen in somebody's life may be random events or accidents, like catching a cold. But the law of karma indicates that the individual is to some extent the author of their own fate. I worked for social services for many years, and I came across all sorts of different sorts of people that I would normally not bump into. And one of them was a man who just had such a difficult life. He never trusted anyone. He suspected the very worst of everybody. He got a bad word for everybody. And he didn't have any friends. He wouldn't let anyone in his house. And and a lot of these the reasons why he lived like this is because he was a crook and entirely dishonest. And he thought that everybody was the same as he was. He thought, this is what I'm like, everybody's like this. And he had a horrid life, actually. And so he created himself through his own actions and thoughts. And it was a sad being. It was such a shame. So importantly, karma is concerned with the intention or motivation behind the action rather than the action itself. So this is why it's so important for us to be aware of our mind and its patterns of behaviour. Only when we are aware and mindful can we know our own intentions, then we can keep an eye on what motivates us. And we can kid ourselves. We can kid ourselves. So I have favourites which I have to keep an eye on. One of them is, if no one sees me doing it, it hasn't happened. Which is not true. Which is like a desire to get away with things. And another one I got is, if I do something that's a bit dodgy, I might as well do lots of it. it's the hung for the sheep. You might as well be hung for a sheep as for a lamb kind of attitude. And I have to watch out for both of those, because they can be quite alive in me. We've all got our own ways that we let ourselves off the hook. And those are two of my better ways of trying to do it. The important thing is that we must stay kind of quite loose with this understanding of karma, because we really never really know the outcomes of our actions. We can never be really sure what they are, because conditionality is so complex that we can just have a feel for it, really. We can, however, be sure that our actions will change us and the world around us. It cannot be otherwise. We do not live in isolation or act in isolation ever. Helpfully, the Buddha laid down some clear guidelines for ethical behaviour, and they're manifestations of a clear ethical order that is inherent in the universe. And the law of karma responds to this clear ethical order. And we have the precepts, which are very clear, and they're guidelines, they're training principles for actions. And they're based on our mental states. And as practicing Buddhists, it's vitally important that we understand the actions that will enhance our path to enlightenment and those that will hold us back. So acting ethically and refining your karma is where the work of the spiritual life takes place. Karma moulds and modifies our consciousness, if we're not making, for instance, if we're not making progress in meditation, it is because we are either not ethically skillful in our day-to-day life, so we are bothered by our actions, bothered by what we're doing, wondering what's going to happen, is someone going to find us out? Do we need to avoid anybody? Do we need to apologise? You know, these things take up our mind. Or we don't know our minds well enough, we're not mindful enough, we're not aware enough. It's not that we need to change our meditation technique. It's just that we need to act in the understanding of the karmic consequences of our actions and become increasingly skillful. Karma takes us forward on the spiritual life. It's really important. It's really important that we understand this. Fortunately, you can counteract the future effects of past skillful actions by creating a counterbalancing weight of ethically skillful karma, which is good. We're never fully damned. We're never damned. We can always create situations which we can rise above things that we've done in the past. So we're going to go back to Milarepa now. We're going to go back to Milarepa. So when Milarepa recognised the damage he'd done by his actions, these are the sort of things that he sought to do. He knew he had to counteract the future effects of his past unskillful actions by counterbalancing weight of ethically skillful karma. He had to change. He had to change quite dramatically. He understood that without doing something, the karmic consequences of the actions on his life and possibly future lives would be devastating. He was overcome with remorse and the desire to gain enlightenment in this lifetime, which was the only way he knew of purging such terrible karmic consequences of his actions. And he said later of this stage in his life, "I was filled with remorse for the evil I had done by magic and by hailstones. My longing for teaching so obsessed me that I forgot to eat. If I went out, I wanted to stay in. If I stayed in, I wanted to go out. At night, sleep escaped me. I asked myself increasingly and passionately by what means I might practice the Turing teaching." And I've got a real sense there of the kind of restlessness that's involved with being very uncomfortable about how you've acted and what's happening to you. I just really respond to his description there. So Milarepa was urgently and desperately looking for a teacher, someone who could teach him the way to overcome the consequences of his past actions. I just want to mention here that it's important to understand that not all our difficult or painful situations are a result of our actions. There's lots of forms of conditionality, and karma is just one. It's just one form of conditionality. And there might be others at work. But there are always ways in which we can ways we can live which will help whatever is going on. So we can accept and bear the fruits of past unskillful actions graciously. Okay. So if we're feeling uncomfortable because we've acted badly, just accept it. Not blame someone else for how we feel. It's not their fault. I mean, it's because we're uncomfortable with ourselves that we're not having an easy time with it. We can take positive steps to cultivate the skillful actions based on kindness, generosity, and clarity. We can just do positive things about it, not just avoid the unskillful. So develop kindness, generosity, truthfulness. I used to work part-time. I'll go back to my working days. I used to work part-time. So there were instances where I would come in from work the next week and somebody had dealt with, my office had dealt with one of my people that I saw because they'd had a crisis while I wasn't at work. And I wasn't always pleased with what had happened. because I had some very particular ways of thinking the way things should have gone. And I was often quite sharp with people. I mean, they'd done their best. They'd stepped in, they'd intervened in often quite difficult circumstances to do something on my behalf because I wasn't there, and then I'd be cross with them. And I just got to the stage where I could just see what was happening. You know, I could see that I might have done it differently, but they were acting generously and genuinely on my behalf. And so I made it a rule that if I got sharp with somebody, that I would apologise. You know, I would always apologise. And I apologised for 2 years before I learned to stop doing it. And what taught me to stop doing it was humiliation and boredom. So it took quite a lot of energy on my behalf to go to somebody and say, look, I'm sorry, I was a bit sharp with you. You actually did your best and you stepped in for me, and I am grateful, you know. And the other thing was, I got so fed up with having to do it that I had to stop. I had to stop my sharp mouth. Basically, I had to learn not to do it. So, I don't do it. I might do it sometimes. I might do it a bit, but nothing like I used to. So I'm really pleased at that. So it was worth the effort. It was worth the effort. So we can not only apologise, but if we can also seek to make amends, and we can resolve not to do things again like that. And those are important, skillful actions that we can take when we have not acted as well as we might do. And we can create what's called weighty positive karma, just through having a very effective meditation practice. Meditation in itself is a karmically skillful, weighty action. Our energies are going into being more mindful, more aware, so that we can act better in the world. It's a really positive thing we can do. And we can become enlightened. This is the most effective way of dealing with negative karma. It's not that the karma does not exist anymore. It's just that your actions are completely aligned with the workings of conditionality. So you don't get in the way of karmic consequences. There aren't karmic consequences to your actions because you're entirely in line with the way things are. And this last way is the way that Milarepa took. He decided that he would have to become enlightened because it was the only way he could escape from the devastating consequences of his actions. And he turned to a teacher called Rongtun, who sent him to a very famous teacher called Marpa. And Marpa was a translator of the Dharma. He travelled extensively, and he just returned from India after many years of studying there. So he was a very knowledgeable man. And Marpa really understood the gravity of Milarepa's situation, and that without becoming enlightened in this lifetime, Milarepa would be born into a hell realm. So Marpa saw in Milarepa a man of enormous potential and determination. He could see what he'd done, you know. He'd mastered black arts and destroyed his family. He could see his determination and his potential. But he also saw that Milarepa would need to purge himself of the karmic consequences of his actions. And this took about 6 years. Marpa, through his compassion, subjected Milarepa to grueling routine. Milarepa's situation was so urgent that only the most intense practice would be of any use to him. And to be able to teach him intense practices, he would need to be purified of his past actions. So, on the outside, it appears that Marpa treated Milarepa very badly. He treated him as a servant. He made Milarepa build towers. He had to fetch every single stone and every bit of earth himself. He first built a round tower in the eastern direction, then a semicircular tower, and then a triangular tower, and he made them build them on different mountain ridges. And when they were done, Marpa made them take him down and down, return the stones to where they come from, and the earth to the holes where they had been dug from. So Marpa made him build and destroy, build and destroy. And each time Minareto obeyed this teacher, because his need for initiation to the Dharma was so strong that he would put up with that. He would put up with that. And in the end, Milarepa became very ill and covered in sores. His body was completely worn out, and he contemplated suicide. And Milarepa said of what happened at this stage of his life, and Marpa, "I reduced my body to powder in his service. I reduced my body to powder in his service. I'm very strong." He did everything. He did everything to gain initiation, spiritual initiation. But it was an ordeal. So it might be difficult to understand why Marpa treated Milarepa in such a harsh way. And the story of their relationship is a story of frustration, disappointment, torment, physical and mental hardship. Marpa tests his faith and commitment in order to purify him of his past karmic consequences of his actions, his past shocking deeds. But through those really difficult circumstances, Milarepa also showed Marpa that he could act skillfully in the most hostile circumstances. He showed great loyalty to Marpa, his teacher, and great obedience to him, which he would need for spiritual progress. He would need to do as Marpa instructed in his spiritual life to be able to reap the benefits. Milarepa didn't understand what was going on, and he was very confused, but he trusted Marpa. He trusted Marpa as a teacher of the Dharma and a master himself. Milarepa showed great patience and tenacity, and he could put his own wishes and comforts to one side for the sake of progress. He was dedicated, he was committed, he was able to take instruction, and he was worthy of Marpa's time and effort. So, and all these are qualities that we need to some extent in our own spiritual lives. We need not to have to be able to just stick it out, see it through, not give up. In the end, Marpa's wife begged Marpa to teach Milarepa, and he does. And he gives him initiation and instruction into the highest Dharmic teachings. And because Milarepa has shown that he can follow them, that he has the ability to carry the instructions out. And Marpa then begins to prepare him for a life of meditation and renunciation. And it's a really, we're not even a quarter of the way through the book yet. Milarepa eventually goes on to be a famous teacher with many disciples, which is another story, or a whole load of other stories, actually. So it's important to know that there's also positive, helpful karma, the fruits of skillful ethical actions. And this is known as punya, or merit. Okay. And very often the results of our karmic action, our actions that we notice, are through our awareness of our mental states. When we've been unskillful, we may have feelings of shame and regret. We might fear that we'd be found out, or fear the judgment of people we respect. When we experience punya, or merit, our mind is calm, it's happy, it's relaxed, and unperturbed. It's a completely different kind of way of being. And when Milarepa had finished building the towers, he had purged himself of the negative karma of the murders and hailstones. He didn't even experience guilt. He was free of negative mental states attached to those actions. He was free of the consequences of these actions. So Milarepa went on to live an ascetic life, but also a life dedicated to joyfulness. And he had learned to find pleasure in a way which is in harmony with pratitasamapada, in harmony with the way things are. And he, through his faith and spiritual aspirations, he sang joyous with a boy with a body free from harmful karma, joyous in confusion of diversity, joyous amidst fearful appearances, joyous exceedingly where hardship is great, joyous in freedom from sickness, joyous that suffering has turned to joy. So whatever circumstances were, whatever was going on, he could be happy and contented. As an enlightened being, Milarepa enjoys the complete equanimity of mind in all circumstances. His mind does not crave or push away. His response is always one of further positivity, further skillful activity, which he experiences as the playfulness of the enlightened mind. So, what can we learn from this story, or this part of his story? One of the big learnings is that we need to take responsibility for our actions. That no one can do this work for us. We need to recognise what we're like, what we've done, and do something about it. And it doesn't matter what we've done in a lot of ways, what our past actions have been like. We can change. We can move towards being more skillful, more positive. I have a friend who's an order member who lives in Newcastle at Cooper, and he's a prison chaplain. He gave a talk once about his Buddhist chaplaincy in prisons, and he said that there were more Buddhists in British prisons than any other faith. And he said he just wanted to point out that they weren't Buddhists when they did their crimes. That these people were converting to Buddhism in prison because they understood karma. Karma had come and punched them on the nose. They were in prison for what they'd done. They were, loss of liberation and everything that goes with that. And the Dharma made sense of it. So Buddhism was a really powerful force in prisons for change in people's lives. So they'd ended up in prison as a result of their actions. And you know that karma is real. You can see what's happened. So they're open to the Dharma and can see its truth and can work towards changing themselves. So you can always change. You could always do something about your situation. And Milarepa's story also is about trusting your instincts. When he had the shock of realisation about what he had done and what it might mean to him, he knew there was a way out and he went looking for it. So we're probably all here because we have some kind of instinctive response to finding another way of living, to an instinctive response to the way we had been living as not being quite enough in some ways. So if you become aware of a kind of higher purpose or something that draws you, follow it. Don't ignore it. Don't pretend it's not there. That's a bit of intuition or awareness could be a result of your past skillful actions. You might just know it's true in a kind of deeper level that you're not necessarily conscious of. You have a trajectory maybe that you're not aware of. I remember reading a book years and years ago by a bloke called Ram Dass, and he's a Hindu. He's an American Hindu, and he was a sidekick of Timothy Leary in the university disturbances in America in the late 60s. And I read a book called Grist for the Mill. Oh, I don't know, I must have fallen over it in the library or something. I remember reading this book, and on chapter 3, it said, if you've come this far through the book, you are a spiritual person. And I thought, ooh. Because I never thought of myself anything like that at all. But I had got to chapter 3, and I was still interested. And maybe he was right. And I just thought, well, it just hit me, there might be something else going on. There might be something else going on. So follow an instinct. If something, happens to you and it just goes, it's a bit of a shock, have a look at it. It might be sending you off in another direction. So, and spiritual life isn't, we can also learn that spiritual life is not always easy. Fortunately for us, and hopefully, it's not as difficult as it is for Milarepa. But we do need the gifts of challenge and hardship at times to actually drive us forward. We need to have some kind of clarity so that we need to be, sometimes I need to be up against something to change. I need to know that it's difficult. And know and put myself behind it for it to make a difference. And also it's very useful to be aware of the benefit and outcome of skillful choices. So creating positive karmic circumstances for yourself. So notice when you're happy and contented. Don't take it for granted. Just notice those mental states as well. They're just as important as anything that's difficult. And if there's no obvious reason for being happy or contented or relaxed or joyful, delighted, it could be well that you have acted very well and skillfully and you are reaping the benefits. All our actions have consequences. And we need to appreciate that in its totality. So it might be that you have just acquired merit. You are a being of punya. And it's very easy to write these things off. So we might just go, oh, it's just good luck. Or it's, random. Something good happens to us and it's random. The law of pratitisana part of conditionality says that nothing is random. Randomness does not exist. If we don't understand what's going on, it's just because we don't understand what's going on. And I don't think good luck exists for Buddhists, because luck, in that sense, appears to be random. So we might not understand what's happened, but fortunate circumstances can be the hard-won fruits of skillful action of our practice. So be aware of those good things in our lives, those mental states where we're relaxed, at peace, experience happiness and joy and delight. And just notice and dwell in these lovely states of mind. Because even inexplicable happiness can be explained. And we can just take seriously the lessons of Milarepa, and as he said, life is short and the time of death is uncertain, so apply yourself to meditation. Avoid doing evil, acquire merit to the best of your ability, even at the cost of life itself, because it nearly brought him to death. In short, act so that you have no cause to be ashamed of yourselves and hold fast to this rule.